And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started.
From Hollywood, Lawrence Welk presents Top Tune. And new talent.
Mike, one of the things that Patty and I were discussing was here you are, this huge celebrity from 15 to 17 years old. You obviously were quite the looker and had lots of girls to choose from. But now you're leaving LA and you're coming back to Detroit. I'm so curious what it was like for you at the age of 17 to come back from LA and this whole lifestyle back home. How were you received? What did you do next? What was it like coming home at 17?
Finishing up high school at Grosse Pointe South. The real Grosse Pointe. That was real interesting. Real interesting. I bought a Stingray. The third Stingray to hit the state. All black. The 327 fuel-injected engine, convertible, removable hardtop. I would pile at high school. And I had it in high school. I would pile three girls into the front seat of that Stingray. Oh, God. And the cops stopped me. And they stopped the car, gave me a ticket, and took me to the Grosse Pointe Farms police station.
Mickey, how did the kids receive you? Were they even aware, were they watching Lawrence?
At high school?
I mean, did they know, what you were coming back from and how did they treat you and stuff?
Again, high school, rich kids. Half of them don't know what their name is. And they got daddy's car, in high school. And we had an open lunch. So you could do anything you want on lunch. You'd go across the street, you'd take a ride in your car. They were rich kids, the girls and the boys. And I wasn't a soch, and I wasn't a grease, and I wasn't a name athlete. I was the music guy.
Were they snotty with you?
Some of them were, absolutely, without any doubt. Rich kids are 90% snobby.
Well, and the reason why I'm asking is because, Patty, you and I talked about this with the Pleasure Seekers early on, that who was Susie's best friend who ended up leaving? Was it Nan? Who would make remarks to Susie? And I asked you if it was
Mary Lou would make fun of Susie. They were a family with money. He worked for Ford, and she would knock her, they would put on a dress or something, and she'd make a comment about her shoes or something. And there was this store called the Village Store, and they had the shoes that matched the kilt and stuff. And we couldn't afford any of that. So Mary Lou would, she had all the skirts and everything, and she would make fun of, she drove Susie crazy. Just this underhanded cutting her,
Snide remarks. I'm better than you because I come from a rich family.
Yes. We definitely had that. Because we were not funds in Grosse Pointe. We lived on Torrey Road. We had a nice house, like all of them.
It was not a $500,000 house.
And we weren't rich. Dad worked his ass off to give five kids a good life. He had a day gig and a night gig. Those families didn't. Their dad worked for the car factories or whatever, and they had the money already. A different life. Different life.
Mickey, when you came to Detroit, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to keep on this. When you came back to Detroit, and yes, you're in high school and you're driving your Corvette, but did you continue to play music with your dad or in bands?
Of course, with my dad, and I had my own band. He would book me as he booked our Quattro Orchestra. He would book Michael Quattro.
And is that how you were billed, Michael Quattro?
Yeah, I was called Michael Quattro. And it was sometimes it'd just be a trio at the Grosse Pointe Yacht Club. Sometimes it'd be a duo. Sometimes it'd just be me playing piano for Mother's Day at one of the clubs.
What's the four people trio?
Oh yeah.
What's
when
that?
When I started to book bands and everything, I followed my dad's lead. I even used little index cards to pay them in, you know, et cetera, which he did. And I was looking at the index card of him making a payroll, and I said, "What is this fourth person on this trio?" He said, "That's a four-man trio." I said, "What's that?" I said, "Well, we pay the manager of who got us the date a fee equal to the musician's fee. So it's called a four-man trio."
Well, you have the best stories, and that's what season three is going to be about. And I just can't wait. So let's get back to, you're back in Detroit. It's 59.
Yeah.
59, hear 59. Mike, I want to hear your
59, 60.
60.
It's 60. I'm in high school. I graduated in 62.
Okay.
So I'm in my final. Yeah.
In the midst of this high school experience, and we are now historically at a moment in Detroit where not only is Motown happening, but there is a nascent rock scene starting to emerge, homegrown. So I want to hear your take on the early rock scene in Detroit, what you were seeing and experiencing. And I also want to hear your take on what it was like when your sisters started to form a band called the Pleasure Seekers. But since the Pleasure Seekers didn't start till 64, take us back over the years of between 60 and 63 and a half of what you were experiencing there in Detroit musically.
Well, I was playing a lot, you know, a whole lot. And I was looking at booking like my dad was doing. And eventually I just kept playing dates and was paying attention to my, what I heard when I went here, went there. I would hear some early rock bands, and I started to book, and I think it was about 74 that I started to book pretty heavily, and I thought that I've got to book rock.
Mike, so just to clarify, you mean 1964?
Yeah, 1964, yeah.
Okay,
go on. I started the Michael Quattro Agency. The agency, Michael Quattro Agency. And I also wanted to produce shows. And I started doing the first rock promotions. Anyway, the first person I signed to the agency was Ted Nugent. Yep, he called me from Chicago. And I put him in, and then I never signed an actual contract for Bob Seger. Punchy never signed a contract with me, the son of a bitch, but I booked 90% of his dates, but he never signed a contract with me. It was just
why do you call him
verbal.
Punchy?
Because that was his nickname, Punch Andrews, Bob Seger's manager. And he came from a rich Grosse Pointe family. And the most prolific thing I ever did for him was around Main Street, the time of Main Street album. And Punchy and I were talking, and he said, "Michael, you know, my dad wants me to quit managing and come to work for his billion-dollar company." And I said, "You know, and I'm probably down this much doing this." And I said, "Yo, look, you're with Capitol, okay? And you're doing a new album. And you go to the chairman of the board of Capitol." By that time, I was, you know, very prominent in the entertainment industry for booking who I was booking already and being known as a quantity to deal with, being the only rock agency between Hollywood and New York and having all those bands. I ended up during the agency years with 14 bands that sold a half a billion records. I didn't make money on the records. I made money on the bookings. So there were 14 different bands. I never signed a contract with Grand Funk either, but I booked 90% of the dates during those years. I remember the one big smell that I got from Grand Funk's manager, Terry Knight. He wanted on that Cincinnati Midsummer Night's Rock Show. It was 1970 by now. They were happening. They were big. He needed on that show. I couldn't put him on. I had 12 acts already. He also wanted on the Joe Cocker Show. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I got it wrong. He wanted on the Joe Cocker Show at Cincinnati Gardens, which was 3 months ahead of the June 10th, 1970 Midsummer Night's Rock Show, my final and biggest pop festival that drew 125,000 people. Anyway, he wanted on the Joe Cocker Show, which was in March. He needed on that show. I couldn't get him on that show. Joe Cocker, D. Anthony, did not want Grand Funk on that show. So I told that to Terry Knight. Now, about 2 weeks later, I'm putting together the Midsummer Night's Rock complete show. 10 years after Cooper, Seeger, Nugent. Oh, God, what a show. 12 acts, 12 hours, $6. Anyway, I wanted Grand Funk. And I called him up and I said, okay, I need Grand Funk on this show. What's my price as a promoter? And he said, well, we're getting $10,000 a night right now. But for you, it's 20. He charged me double because I didn't get him on a Joe Cocker show as a promoter. Charged me fucking double. I never forgot that.
Did you pay it?
Anyway, they played the show. Oh, he did it. I paid it. Yeah, fucking right. I needed him on that show. It's crazy.
So before we were
$10,000 a night, for you it's double.
Mike, I want
rock and roll politics. I never played a date with Bob Seger again after the newspaper printed my remark at the Aragon Ballroom, Chicago Today. It's no longer a paper. You know, I got absorbed by other papers. But the interviewer said, how are you going to do tonight? I said, we're going to knock Seger off the stage. What a stupid thing for me to say. Jesus fucking Christ. How stupid. How fucking stupid. But that was me. I love Bob Seger. All I was saying was, we're going to do real good. And I remember the one interview in Dallas. Well, how do you do? Well, rock and roll politics are such. A, you got to satisfy the promoter. B, you got to satisfy the headline act if you're a special guest. And C, if you're lucky, you get to satisfy the audience.
So, Mike, before we round out, you filling in so much. I love this. All of the stories from season two that Patty and I did. What was it like for you when you first saw the Pleasure Seekers start to play gigs and start to get the reception that they were receiving? I mean, some of them were your sisters. What was this like for you?
Like normal. Like you're a quattro. You should play great.
So you thought they played great.
You got the quattro talent. It was just absolutely like normal. I never even thought about it. I just thought, oh, they're going to be big. Mm-hmm. And we had them on, Mercury Records. Mercury Records. And they weren't doing shit. They weren't doing shit.
Well, so we're going to get into all of this in more depth. But the reason why I wanted your take on the Pleasure Seekers is, knowing you the way I do a little bit, I assume that ego would trump nepotism, meaning if your sisters had not been very talented, I don't think you would have put them on the bills.
Nope. I would have known, but it was the first time I saw them in rehearsal as I started to book them on concerts. And I was very good at booking, you know, oh, you got to have this band, the Pleasure Seekers. They're the best, you know. And of course, as I told you before, Patty is probably the best girl guitar player that ever lived.
Oh,
probably
geez,
the best.
Come on.
No. She is. She's the best girl guitar player that ever worked in rock and roll. She plays guitar like Joan Jett would put on a shoe. You know, I mean, that's a joke. And yet Joan Jett got more bills because than Susie. Why? Because she played rock guitar, and Susie kept playing pop, had pop guitar. She was stuck with her husband, Lenny Tuckey, who could play on a scale of 1 to 10, he was about a 5. About
Patty,
a 5.
Patty,
on a good day.
Well, no, I have my feelings. First of all, you're very prejudiced, and I love you for it. But I mean, I was a pioneer. I granted, I was an early one doing stuff that no girls were doing on guitar.
And that's so, right.
But I mean, there's a lot of fabulous ones now. They've carried the flame so forward.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. There's good girl guitar players now.
I just contexting it. Yes, I was for that era. And I mean, Susie did stay more in pop, and that was her management. He twisted it that way and wouldn't let her come to America. He didn't want to lose her. That's a whole story. That's a whole episode. You know, she wanted to come to America very badly, and Joan just stomped all over it, showed up at every one of Susie's gigs and took over her persona. And she's the one that really made it big here. I mean, that's a whole episode. I'm telling you the story of how that rolled out.
An episode or two or seven. Yes, we were definitely getting to that. Definitely. So, Mike, before we say goodbye for now, I would love for you to tell the listeners your story of when you were booking your, as Patty calls them, homeboys in Detroit, and the band names that you gave to them that everybody loved. Oh. Giggled over. And after you tell us the names, tell us about how you paid them with your contracts.
Right. This was the second Saugatuck Pop Festival, July 4th weekend, 1969. And we pre-sold on that show about 90% of the gate. And the show ran Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And the manager of one of my bands, the big ones, Pete Andrews, he had to build a stage. And it was at Saugatuck. And that's where we were putting the second one on, at Saugatuck. And I decided for a joke that I would make up special contracts for all the bands on the show. So I wrote up contracts. First of all, the location on the contracts was Soggy Fuck instead of Saugatuck. and then each band had their own. The MC5 were called the Empty Jive. It was Ted Nugent was called Fitz Nugent and the Amboy Pukes. SRC were called City Rotten Crap. I had names for everybody. And then I paid everybody in Japanese yen, Euro March, London, you name it. I had about 18 different currencies. The bands loved them. They loved the contracts. I'm sure they still have a copy of them today. I don't. I should have kept the copy.
Well, one of the things that your sister said, which I really want to give you props for, is that as much as you teased them, the bands that played and had fun with them, that you always paid them. And that they really respected you for that, that they always got paid.
Not only did, as a promoter, did I pay all the bands, but I went to extra lengths to make sure they got paid properly. I remember the most prolific moment of that was the MC5. They're playing the Grandy Ballroom. And I'm looking at the gate as we're coming in because we're out of percentage. Okay. And I'm seeing the ticket taker, which is one of Gabe Glantz's relatives, was handing tickets to the next person. He was absorbing and getting double. And so I said, hey, you're going to pay me another 20%. And I went back to Gabe and I said, you're paying me another 20% today because this is what you're doing at the door. I remember that.
You did that a lot, Mickey, because I know, again, it's another episode, but how you got involved in a lot of negotiations with record companies and helping.
Oh, I did. Absolutely.
They always said, you know, you gave them a platform, you paid them, you opened them up to getting signed and everything, and you gave them advice to the managers. You did all that to help build Detroit up. I mean, it was a very important thing.
I did whatever I had to do. I went to Mercury Records to meet the owner on Dick Wagner, because they weren't doing proper. You know, here comes the mystery man and all that. You know, I did that. I did that with Ted Nugent. I got him. I think we got him off his original label. Bob Shea was his manager then. I told Bob Seger's drummer to use a double bass, and he did. He did. He used a double bass from that time on. I gave tips to bands and did negotiations with whoever I had to and whatever I had to help them. Anyway, the punch story, Patty, was when they were doing Main Street, was and he's behind all this money. I said, here's what you do. You go to the chairman of the board of Capitol. You don't deal with anybody else. You go to the chairman of the board and you say, I'll put up $200,000 in marketing on the next album if you put up $250,000. And that's what Capitol did. And that's Main Street. That's how that happened.
That's fantastic. Well, as we finish up this episode, I just wanted to say that I love these connections. Patty, you and I met in 1974 when you came out to LA to join a band called Fanny, having left your brother in the band you were working on with your brother. And then Mike, you are out in LA working on your album in collaboration with the Gods. And that album cover is you at the house where Patty was living, my house, my dad's house. And I just love that we share these connections. And I look forward to having both of you back for season 3 and hearing more stories. So, Mike, thank you so much. Patty, thank you.
You're welcome.
Goodbye, all.